You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm David Hyde with Steve Scherer. Steve, you remember that game show Family Feud?
Richard somebody, the English guy, getting families to fight?
Exactly. So I have a Family Feud-style question for you. What media company is Rupert Murdoch best known for starting here in the United States?
Fox News.
Exactly. Rupert Murdoch, best known for launching Fox News, but our guest today says Rupert Murdoch's motivations and politics are a lot more complicated than you might guess from watching Fox. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik's new book on Rupert Murdoch is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. And I spoke with David Folkenflik earlier. He started out explaining how Fox News got started.
He sort of forced his way to the table by buying up these weaker signal television stations in cities around the country and forging them into the Fox network. And by that, I mean the Fox broadcast network, you know, where you watch NFC games on the weekends. And in stealing, essentially, the NFC games away from CBS, which shocked CBS, they still thought of it, this as a world where there would only ever be three networks that mattered. He did that as a loss leader, as he's done in other places, because he thought if you get the best sports content, that's one way to ensure that you're going to have loyal viewers. But he looked with great envy over at 60 Minutes, which was, you know, the show that follows the Sunday night football games. And he thought, if I can get a show like that, that's a top 10 show almost every year. If I can get a show like that to follow the football games, I can do it. So he wanted to create a conservative leaning because he saw CBS as being liberal, just like, you know, the New York Times and NBC and everybody else that he looked at. He says, if we can create one that's a little more to the right, we're going to do something really well. Well, they brought in a couple of anchors and they toyed around with the idea. And then he brought in the consultant. The consultant said, forget the show. What if we do a cable channel? The consultant's name was Roger Ailes. He had been a key consultant to President Nixon in 1968 on TV Matters, a very successful television programmer. He was the executive producer of the Mike Douglas show back in the day. And he went on to be a top executive at CNBC and helped that channel really become an established success. And Ailes said, look, there's low-hanging fruit here. We've got basically half the country that thinks that the media is liberal. Let's reinforce that. Let's give them something they want to watch. And so Fox News, from the very outset, the idea of fair and balanced, you know, was essentially a promise. And it was also a stick in the eye at everyone else. It was saying, we're going to be fair and balanced. And by the way, they're not. And one of the genius elements of it, perhaps not from a journalistic standpoint, but from a branding standpoint, is that part of the steady diet of the stories that they pick reinforced the idea that the American public is not being served by the rest of the media, and the American public is being fed essentially a liberal line by the rest of the media. And that was a huge percentage of the diet, and it reinforced the place that this is a station that people could turn to who felt aggrieved, and it really worked. It's a more conservative tone and a more conservative ideology that you tend to hear from the most bombastic and the most assertive personalities on that channel than Rupert Murdoch himself holds. But it's been such a successful, enormous niche. And when you think of cable, that's really what cable news is a big niche. It's been such a successful one that he's, you know, allowed Ailes a lot of room to run, even as it retains the combative spirit of Murdoch's own sensibilities and his tabloids here and in other countries.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik's new book is Murdoch's World. I want to ask about that. I want to ask more about his politics. And really, since you bring up Roger Ailes, how do the two of them differ?
You know, one of the parts of the genius of Murdoch is that he wields his newspapers, particularly his tabloids, but he wields his newspapers to back certain political figures. But he's a conservative guy, don't get me wrong, but he toggles back and forth between parties. So both in this country and in Australia, where he was born, and in the UK, where he controls over a third of all national newspaper circulation. He goes between sort of these center-left candidates and these much more conservative figures on the right. So you get Margaret Thatcher, but who's a very, very conservative Tory figure. But you also get Tony Blair, a center-left prime minister whom he supported three times for election there and swung his four major newspapers behind the Blair push. Similarly, when Hillary Clinton ran for Senate in 2000, he thought this is not an ideological liberal. This is a pragmatic figure on the center left, and I think she's going to win. If she's going to win anyway, I want her to feel that she owes me something. The New York Post, not usually that hospitable Democrats, swung around and supported her. So he toggles back and forth. You're never going to find Roger Ailes to do that.
Okay, so there's this relationship that Murdoch has to somebody like Roger Ailes, but what about in all of his properties? How much does he invest his personal politics into these places? I mean, he has the ability to do it if he wants to. Is it like he sets it up and kind of lets it run, or does he get involved in a sort of more active way?
Well, look, Roger Ailes, I think, has a tremendous amount of authority and autonomy because of the enormous profits that he's been able to generate, you know, $1 billion a year. You know, it's a lot of money for the Murdoch fortunes. And so he's given leeway, although Murdoch will touch base with him on that. I think you best find Murdoch's sensibility in the tabloids. You know, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page was actually more conservative than Murdoch before he ever bought it. The two editors he appointed, Robert Thompson and now Gerard Baker, shared Mr. Murdoch's belief that newspapers are generally too liberal, and that even the reporting of what's considered a very straight ahead news report in the news pages of the Wall Street Journal, that even that was too liberal. And so in doing reporting for the book, I found two to three dozen cases in which reporters and editors said they felt that thumb was being put on the scale and that stories were being pulled to the right, you know, liberal voices being pushed farther down in stories, conservative voices being brought up, questions or credibility of credibility, doubts cast upon sources who are more Democratic or liberal consistently. And they said, look, it may be that these guys are right and that we've been a little reflexive in thinking about certain issues. But at the same time, it feels like every time the story is being pulled to the right, they're never asking the question in the other direction. So you see a little bit of that. But that's his most prestigious newspaper and news holding. And his tabloids, you know, it used to be in the days before email and before caller ID, I'm told, that the tabloid editors had two phones on their desk, and one was their phone. And, you know, they'd had secretary handle calls, but nonetheless, they had a phone. And the other was a phone to which only Rupert Murdoch and maybe their spouse had the number. And they knew if the bat phone called, you know, and rang, they had to pick it up, and it'd be, is it Murdoch here? You know, what do you know? You know, he wanted to know what the gossip was. He employs a fleet and a flotilla of gossip reporters throughout his empire, you know, particularly in these three great English-speaking nations, right? Australia, the UK, the US. And yet there's nobody who's a bigger gossip than Rupert Murdoch. He wants to know. He's so interested in the powerful, particularly politicians, corporate chieftains like himself. You know, he's just very interested in that. And, you know, he feels that an hour not on the phone at times is an hour wasted. So he would just figure out what the time zone is, and wherever it's morning, he's going to call the editors and say, what do you think? The other thing is he's appointing people who know how he thinks. You know, I had Ken Chandler, former editor and a publisher of The New York Post, said, look, The New York Post has never made him a dime. You know, it loses between $50 and $100 million every year. And he has it because it gives him a seat at the table and a chance to influence the public conversation. But by all rights, several hundred people here shouldn't have jobs. So I'm going to produce a paper every day that Murdoch would want to read. And the New York Post is a pretty excellent reflection of his center-right, populist, sort of anti-authority, anti-elite, you know, bruising, often you know, waging enemy on wars on his enemies. But nonetheless, that's his sensibility. In the UK, he said under oath, if you want to know what I think, you should read the Sun tabloid. That's a pretty strong directive to anybody. And there's not only are there the phone calls that occasionally give directives, he now has his own Twitter feed. So every day, often on an hourly basis, editors are going to track that because they want to know what the guy at the head of the pyramid thinks. You know, he's had to apologize a number of times. I once said to one of his top aides, you know, have you ever said to him, you know, is it really such a good idea for him to be doing this? And the guy said to me, okay, you be the guy to tell him to stop. I'm not going to be the one who does that.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm David Hyde with Steve Scherr. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik's new book on Rupert Murdoch is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. We heard the first part of that interview earlier today, and I'm here with Steve Scherr. And Steve, was there anything in that interview that really made your ears perk up?
No, I remember learning about Murdoch, that he came out of Australia, that he was a young guy, wanted to show his parents that he was going to be a great success. I thought it was interesting in that conversation that he was willing to befriend people across the political spectrum. He's an opportunist.
Right. Not as conservative as you might think, even though he did start Fox News. It's so pretty interesting book. In the second part of this interview, Folkenflik talks about Murdoch's legacy, starting with the telephone hacking and bribery scandal in England, where many of Murdoch's former colleagues are currently on trial. What's been the fallout, without getting into all the details about what happened, what's been the fallout for him?
the broadest brushstrokes, you know, you're talking about the accusations that his journalist people working there essentially had targeted thousands of people, and it was sort of known in the ether that stuff like this might be hacking. But, you know, when you think about this happening to the royal family, you know, that led to two guys going to jail. When you think about this happening to celebrities and politicians, the public is, that's fine. You know, it's that's raw meat for the tabloids. Those guys are there for our entertainment. They're probably on the take or philanderers anyway. When this started, it turned out this happened to a 13-year-old murder victim. It happened to victims of the July 2005 terrorist attacks. It happened to war dead from British armed forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. The public was, you know, repulsed by this, and quite understandably so. Politicians who have been sort of courting the Murdoch and his executives for decades started to recoil, some of them running fully away from people whose support, you know, they desperately sought. You know, and it's got to be clear, you know, politicians of both major parties in the UK had been solicitous and eager to woo him. You know, it's not just a one-party dynamic because of the toggling it back and forth. Look, it's cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. He had to close the News of the World, the best-selling Sunday paper in the UK. His son James's chances of succeeding him, which were on a pure glide path, which is something that Murdoch desperately wanted to occur, to have one of his adult children lead this what is a publicly traded company but what he thinks of as a personal possession. Those seem to be exploded. You know, James is quietly trying to work his way back into good graces with investors and the public. I think he thinks if he has enough years with his father at the helm, he might be able to pull it off. But it sure seems like it's not going to happen. So, you know, Murdoch could say, look, we've had all these people who have are now on trial. I've lost hundreds of millions of dollars of the company. He had to split the company in two earlier this year. And the implication of that, you know, he now has a thinner, smaller News Corp, which is really the newspaper company plus the publishing house and some other investments. And then he's got these much more profitable broadcast and entertainment elements, including Fox News, the Fox Channel, B Sky B in England, much more profitable elements. It used to be that the profits of the entertainment side for the past 5-10 years have really insulated the newspapers, which have seen their revenues, although they are dominant newspapers, their revenues take such a battering along with the rest of the newspaper industry. Now they are much more isolated. So, you know, News Corp just in recent days had an earnings report in which it wasn't able to meet the expectations that analysts had set after talking to News Corp executives. Well, that means that they haven't been able to, you know, maintain even the more modest profits for that company that they had hoped to sustain. So there's real threat there. On the other hand, Murdoch's not in the dock. Here in the U.S., although there are laws such as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that could be applied to the allegations of widespread bribery from the newsrooms of the Sun and News of the World over in England that basically say American companies can't bribe people abroad. You know, so far there have been no charges under that. Murdoch established The Sun on Sunday, a sister paper to its a Daily Sun tabloid there, and it's recouped much, not all, but much of its circulation. They still have about 36-38% of the national newspaper circulation in the UK, which is basically a national newspaper market as opposed to what we have here more regionally. So, you know, you look at that. They set up the URL for that, by the way, 3 days after the hacking scandal broke in 2011. They were planning for what they would do if they were to kill the News of the World. They've been able to mitigate a lot of damage. He said when he split the companies, this is a chance for me to start a new chapter, to begin all over again. And most CEOs and chairmen of companies wouldn't talk about the future of publicly traded companies in very personal terms. But he saw this last May as, you know, his chance to prove the naysayers wrong. He could figure out the problems of newspapers. And then, of course, it turned out there was a personal element. He also was filing divorce papers against his third wife, Wendy Deng Murdoch. So he really feels at the age of 82, this is a chance for him to make sure there's a different final chapter to his story, and that he won't be defined at the end solely by this terrible scandal over in the UK.
David Folgenflik is talking about his new book called Murdoch's World. And I want to turn now just to the future, really, and ask you about the changes that have taken place in journalism over the last 20 years. What's his role been in that, and what's his take on the future of news and sort of how to save it?
I mean, Murdoch, I think, through his holdings, and as you say, you know, we know him best here through Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, perhaps The New York Post, has been incredibly influential in introducing into the bloodstream a much more Anglo and Australian sensibility. It's a crueler form of journalism. I think at times it's a more heedless form of journalism. It's more combative. It at times is more entertaining. and livelier. I think you look at the Wall Street Journal, it is in some ways a more lively newspaper, somewhat shorter articles, more general interest, more politics, more international coverage, fewer of the deeper dives, enterprise reporting on finance and business and the economy that we might have ascribed to the journal before. But they're like, you know, they use color much more now. They use photographs much more now. It's just a different kind of sensibility. Fox News, through its success, I think ushered in an era of argumentation that is the core of Fox. The drive to get scoops that so drives the highly competitive tabloid and newspaper market in the UK isn't here. What drives Fox's success is argumentation, you know, verbal conflict. And they have reporters and producers there, some of whom are very good journalists, but that's not the core of what they do. MSNBC didn't make any money until they decided, fine, we're going to pay homage to what Fox did. We're going to bank hard left. We are going to be more consistent. Not all of their shows do that, but a significant number do. And it gave them coherence as a network and profit as a network. That was because of the example of Fox. I think if you look in the digital sphere, News Corp has actually been a much of a laggard, a very slow to be able to embrace things very successfully. The kind of ideological flavor to news that is common in British newspapers and more common in Australian newspapers than it was here, you find reflected in the Huffington Post. You find reflected in Breitbart News, started by the late Andrew Breitbart. And that sensibility, that might have happened in the digital sphere anyway. You know, 1,000 websites all running the same Associated Press article aren't going to be successful, but people with different voices and different sensibilities might well be. So that might have happened without him, but I think he was a forerunner of that.
I want to end then by asking that question, since you're also NPR's media critic as well as the author of a new book about Rupert Murdoch. What does Rupert Murdoch's legacy mean for the future of NPR?
Well, you know, I think NPR is in some ways just a very different approach to journalism. You know, one of the things about Murdoch is he tends to find competitors or rivals as enemies, or at least his news outlets do. And, you know, we tend to think them as just people who approach the job very differently. If you think back to the Juan Williams episode, which I talk about to some degree in the book, you know, it was a moment at which NPR found that it couldn't sustain a guy who talked in a cable news milieu or, you know, setting in one way and was trying to do his job in the NPR. There was a tension. Mara Liasson, you know, according to executives, was able to handle that differently. And whatever you feel the merits of that decision, which, you know, NPR now concedes was handled horribly, you know, Fox News decided that it was a moment to go to war, that it was an opportunity to brand Fox as open for business, as a champion of free speech, that somehow NPR had infringed on his free speech, although NPR is not a government agency, so it has the contractual ability to decide what people say. You know, if a newspaper drops a columnist, there's not the same degree of outcry. But look, you know, Juan was personally very aggrieved, but also Fox News decided it would make it a rallying cry and a cause. And it did so both because it played wonderfully with its audiences. Secondly, because they actually felt very strongly on Juan's behalf that he had been wrongly treated, shabbily treated in a public manner. And the third element was it was just a few weeks before the 2010 midterm elections. And this became part of the Republicans' rallying cry as they sought and successfully to take over the House of Representatives. And so it became part of an ideological campaign, even though it started out with presentation as a journalistic issue. And that's a very Murdochian trait, even though it was on Fox News, which is not something he on a day-to-day level is as involved in guiding. That the idea was we are going to figure out a way to target NPR. Now, the reality is that was a real blow and it ended up in a number of executives ultimately being weakened and some leaving. And at the same time, you know, NPR has, as far as I can tell, maintained its journalistic mission to try to treat things in a thoughtful, contextual, inclusive and civil manner. And, you know, among the things Juan has said is that he was so hurt because he actually valued that very much, that he enjoyed that setting, that he enjoyed the audience's investment in the news, and that he cared a lot about the reporting that went on here. So, you know, NPR doesn't think that people who do the news differently are enemies, as far as I can tell, as both a reporter within it and a critic who assesses how it's doing. You know, our audiences are strong and our loyalty is strong. So you do what you can from that.
David Folkenflik, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik's new book on Rupert Murdoch is called Murdoch's World. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm David Hyde.